And we are super happy to have Laura Donnet from Technical University of Vienna with us, who's going to talk about all those recent exciting advances in asymptotic symmetries and celestial sphere scattering. Take it away.
Thank you very much, Dominique. So thank you for inviting me to give a seminar. That's really a pleasure. Before I start, just want to tell you that you can interrupt me at any moment to ask a question. So just speak out if you have a question. So yeah, this I will present, and I will try to put into context a recent work that we did last year, this year, with Andrea Pum and Sabrina Pasterski, which is also related to an earlier work done with Andrea and Andy Strominger. So as Dominique said, I mean, the main motivation for this work is actually to understand how general is holography. So basically, we all know and love the holographic principle, which is a beautiful story unfolded over the last 20 years. And the main realization of this holographic principle is, of course, known as the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is stating that quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter can be formulated as a conformal field theory that lives at the boundary of ADS. But of course, if holography is a general principle of fundamental laws of nature, then it should also work for flat spacetimes. So for spacetime which have zero cosmological constant. And of course, we live in a de Sitter space, but flat space is a very good approximation for most purposes in physics, especially at astrophysical scales. And for a flat space, we actually know very little about holography. Namely, we do not know for sure if there is dual CFT, and if there is, where does it live and what are its properties. So as we will see, one of the main purposes of this talk will be to make some steps toward holographic formulation for flat spacetimes. Another motivation for that, which is my personal main motivation to study physics, has to do with black holes, and especially understanding the huge amount of entropy. So we still do not really know what are the black hole microstates, even though we have made recent progress for certain kind of black holes. In the 90s, Vaffa and Strominger have came up with the entropy counting for supersymmetric black hole in string theory. And there has been also a recent advance in the so-called Kerr CFT correspondence for extremely spinning black holes. But I think it's fair to say that in all these cases, the success mostly relied not on the specific details of the, say, string theory details, but on the presence of an anti-de Sitter factor in the near horizon region of the black hole that were studied. So somehow our understanding of quantum properties of black holes is closely tied to the great advances of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And as such, the entropy law for black holes, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula, can be seen as the very first holographic relationships, because it states that the entropy scales like the area of the black hole. But as we know, realistic black holes, like this black hole in the center of galaxies, are not necessarily actually extremal. And so they do not possess this ADS decoupling region in their near horizon regions. So if we want to understand entropy for black holes, we better come with the holographic correspondence for asymptotically flat spacetimes. So the aim of the talk is to present recent advances in this direction in a specific context or proposal, which is known as celestial holography. And I will explain what I mean by that. And before that, actually, I will review a salient feature of flat space aseptic symmetries in flat space time, because as we will see, this proposal is actually motivated by new discoveries between the infrastructure of gravity and gauge theories. So I'm sorry for the experts in this room, but I will just start by reviewing what are the infinite dimensional or so-called BMS symmetry of flat spacetime. And then I will turn to what we did in our work in this context of celestial holography. So again, interrupt me anytime. So before talking about asymptotically flat spacetime, let's talk about exactly flat spacetime, namely the Minkowski metric in four dimensions. This is the metric. Now it's convenient to use a retarded time U, in which case the line element is mapped to this one, where I have used here Z and Z bar coordinate, which has complex coordinate instead of the usual theta and phi coordinates, for which the unit sphere, round sphere metric is given by this gamma Z Z bar here. So this is just Minkowski. The Penrose diagram of the spacetime is this picture here. So as you see, in this diagram, the important thing is to notice that light rays propagate always at 45 degrees to respect the causal structure. And one reaches the boundary of flat space, this boundary here called future null infinity, by taking the coordinate r very big and keeping all the other coordinate fixed. So here we have this retarded time root that u that runs along this boundary, which is called scry plus, denoted by this letter here. And the z and z bar are parametrizing the angular coordinates. So each point in this diagram is a two sphere. And the sphere at null infinity is called the celestial sphere. There is an analog of future null infinity in the past called past null infinity. And in this diagram, a massive particle will not end on scry plus, but instead we start from time like past infinity and end here in this place of the diagram. So we will be interested in this talk in a massless particle with enter the spacetime from scry minus, propagates and exit the spacetime at scry plus. So now, what is an asymptotically flat spacetime? Well, it's a spacetime that's seen from very far, looks like Minkowski. So more precisely, an asymptotically flat metric is given by boundary conditions, given in terms of a large R expansion, given as follows. This was the metric introduced by Bondi, Messner, and Sachs in the 60s. So an asymptotically flat metric at first approximation is just Minkowski. This is this first line here. And it has some deviation from Minkowski space, which take this form here. So this function in blue are arbitrary function of the angles and time. And let me tell you a little bit what they mean physically. So this MB here is called the Bondi mass aspect. And roughly speaking, if you take a black hole, like if you take the Kerr black hole and expand and write this metric into these coordinates, the Bondi mass aspect will, in this case, just be a constant. It will be the mass of the black hole. But in full generality, an asymptotically flat spacetime is allowed to have a function here that depends on time and the angle. Similarly, the NZ here is related to the angular momentum, it's called the angular momentum aspect because its integral over the sphere gives you the total angular momentum. And here, the last function here in blue is CZZ, is sometimes called the gravitational data, and is very important because it indicates whether the system, the radiative system that you are, the gravitational system you're looking at is actually radiating gravitational waves. More precisely, if you look at the so-called Bondi news tensor, which is the time derivative of this quantity CZZ, the fact that this tensor is non-zero will tell you that some gravitational waves is escaping out of the space-time, and you can eventually consider yourself as some observer here at Scry Plus that will measure these gravitational waves. And back then, people didn't know whether gravitational waves actually existed, and this was the main motivation of these guys to actually study this kind of metric. So this is an asymptotic flat metric in the sense of Bondi, Messner, van der Burg, and Sachs. So now the question that they raise is, what is the symmetric group of this set of spacetimes? At first sight, one might expect to find as a symmetric group the isometric group of Minkowski, namely the Poincaré group, which consists of 4 spacetime translation and 6 Lorentz transformations. But what people have found, very surprisingly, was not the Poincaré group, but an infinite dimensional extension of it that is now called the BMS group. And the story goes as follows. So if one looks for the so-called asymptotic symmetries, namely a sect of vector fields which preserve when acting with a Lie derivative on this metric, what I mean by preserve is that one is allowed to change the function here in blue, but one is not allowed to change the powers in R in the expansion. If one look for this set of vector fields, one find the following. This Xi F here involves here an arbitrary function FZ of Z bar of the angles. And this has been called a super translation because instead of shifting the time by just merely a constant, now there is an infinite amount of shifting the time, the retarding time, because this function is an arbitrary function on the celestial sphere. So people have called this kind of asymptotic symmetry super translations. And you can figure out what is the action of this vector field on the different functions. And on the gravitational data, the effect of this action is actually the following. And as you can see, it has this part is a pure shift on the data, which means that if you start with pure Minkowski space, so Minkowski space has 0 MB, 0 CZZ, 0 NZ, but act on it with a super translation, it will produce you a new metric that will differ from the pure vacuum from this amount. So sometimes people have called this spontaneous symmetry breaking induced by super translation symmetry. One knows that these are actually general large gauge or physical symmetry when one computes the conserved charge or neutral charges associated to this symmetry. And an important quantity that will play a role in this talk is a so-called soft super translation charge, which is so a charge that is involves an integral over Scry plus and involves this super translation field F. There is another kind of symmetry which have been called super rotations and have been found actually much later in 2008 by Barnick and Troussart. So the reason why this superrotation appear is, well, basically it's also an asymptotic symmetry in the sense that it preserves this set of a metric. And now they realize that basically these superrotations were allowed as asymptotic symmetries if one didn't care so much about the global properties of the space-time, but if you just look at the local, at the locally well-defined vector fields, YZ, then you can see that you have this YZ actually generate not only the pure global conformal transformation, but now the local transformation. In other words, this function YZ and YZ bar, which are holomorphic here, span for you the full Vera zero. Actually, they give you two copies of Vera zero. And this super rotation were not found in the original work by BMS because they wanted to allow only for vector fields that were globally well defined on the sphere. And in this case, the only thing you can find is the six Lorentz transformations. But in CFT, we are used to have this kind of vector fields. And you can also see that the action of this super rotation also involve a shift on the data. And I will come back to this later. So the conclusion of this part is that the asymptotic symmetry algebra of flat space is not merely the Poincaré, but an infinite dimensional extension of it called the BMS algebra. So the super translation enhance the four usual translation of Poincaré, and similarly the super rotations enhance to an infinite amount the six usual Lorentz transformations. So the important thing is that these BMS transformations are really physically changing the metric. And they were originally disregarded by the author. Actually, so the super rotation were disregarded because the vector field were not globally defined, but even the super translations, when these people found super translations, they were deeply unhappy with that because they really wanted to recover the Poincaré group as a symmetry of asymptotically flat space. And they started to try to kill the super translation, namely by imposing a stronger boundary condition such that the super translation would reduce to the usual translations. But what they found is that if they wanted to kill super translation, they also needed to kill gravitational radiation, gravitational waves. So now we know that these symmetries are there and actually have very important implication that have just starting to be understood now. And I will talk about this now. Is there any question at this point?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. One is pretty innocent, maybe a little stupid. If the BMS transformations bring our geometry into a physically inequivalent one, are they really a symmetry?
So they are an asymptotic symmetry.
Okay.
So I will just mention now what is the physical effect. It's actually called a memory effect. But yeah, they are not just, you know, an exact killing vector that when you, the action will give you the same metric, they transform it, but in actually non-trivial way. Another way to say that is that sometimes people make a distinction between small gauge transformation and large gauge transformation. What it means by that is that a large gauge transformation would be, or large diffeomorphism would be a diffeomorphism that does not vanish when you take R very large. So it would be a diffeomorphism that still lives at the boundary. So when you have this feature, typically like it's the case, for instance, in the Brown and Noh computation in the AD3 CFT2, you have what people also call boundary gravitons, or you have things going on here because you have a boundary. So yeah, they are asymptotic symmetries.
Okay, fantastic, thanks. Yeah. And how important is null infinity for this machinery and for the BMS group? Like, could we observe this from Earth with gravitational waves that we receive?
Yes. Yeah, so from our perspective, we would be like sitting at future null infinity, and you could see like the the gravitational waves here, and your detector will detect this NZZ, this function that I showed before. The time derivative of this function, you would in principle, we actually record that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thanks.
So.
Could I ask just a quick question?
Sure.
Are you using Bondi gauge for your generators, and is that important or?
Right. So yeah, here the metric is in the Bondi gauge. So for those who don't know, it's for instance one condition of the Bondi gauge is telling you that GRR is zero. As you see, there is no dr squared here, and there are other conditions. So yeah. The gauge condition is actually an important point, because later in my talk, I will be dealing with objects that are not necessarily satisfying Bondi gauge, but rather the Donder gauge. And it seems that to some extent, in the story of celestial holography, I will talk about later, the harmonic gauge seems better suited than the Bondi gauge for different reasons. But yeah, here I have presented the original historical one. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Another question. If not, I will just mention one of these interesting an implication of BMS symmetry, which is the relation between soft theorems and asymptotic symmetries. So in principle, now I totally changed topic, because I was telling you about general relativity and asymptotic symmetries and all that. And now I will be telling you about quantum field theory and soft theorems. And remarkably, these two topics are related with each other, and they are related in the following way. So the leading subgraviton theorem that was found by Weinberg is a universal formula that relates an amplitude, a scattering amplitude with n particle that involves an extra particle called a soft particle to the amplitude without the soft particle. So the relation is that if you take the limit of one and the n plus one particle to be soft, this amplitude will factorize and will basically reduce to the amplitude without the soft particle times this piece, which is a factor. It's called the soft factor and depends on the momentum of the external particle. And This factor is actually a pole. It's called a soft pole because it goes like 1/ω. And a very interesting relationship with this theorem is that it can be seen as arising from symmetries, from asymptotic symmetries. Actually, there is a very concise statement about that. This was a result that was found a couple of years ago by people at Harvard, is that this soft theorem, the leading subgraviton theorem, is nothing but the Ward identity associated to supertranslation symmetry. So this is very sketchy here, but you can actually show that the BMS supertranslation are symmetry of scattering amplitudes. And the Ward identity associated to this symmetry lands you on this formula, literally. So here I'm skipping all the details, but also what I mean by plus and minus here is that this is the chart defined at future null infinity, and there is an antibodal match between the chart defined and past null infinity. So I'm not explaining you the details. But this was one instance of a very, actually much richer set of relationship, which goes under the name of the infrared triangle, which relate three topics in physics that a priori had nothing to do with each other, The first one is asymptic symmetries, the second soft theorems, and the third one is memory effect. So I will not talk very much about that, but this the memory effects have to do with observation of gravitational waves. And there is a precise relation between these topics. So the one I have just talked about is the fact that sub-theorems can be understood as word identity associated to asymptotic symmetries. One example of this triangle is the one I just presented, namely that the sub-graviton theorem is the word identity associated to support translation. And there is an interesting relation between the so-called displacement memory, which has to do with the detectors and gravitational wave, which can be seen to be actually the real physical manifestation of the symmetry. So another proof that this symmetry are not pure and are not mere diffeomorphism, but really change the physical symmetries. Another example is of this triangle has to do with superrotation. So I told you that on top of supertranslation, we have superrotations. And in this case, Freddy Cacciasso of this group and Andy Strominger have associated to this superrotation a new soft theorem in gravity, which is subleading in the sense that if the soft pole was going as 1 over omega for the leading soft graviton theorem, the subleading part involves an order to the omega to the zero. I recall that omega is the energy of the soft particle that is taken to be vanishing. So this is not only valid for gravity, but also for gauge theories. So there is a copy of this triangle that is valid for QED, where now you have what people call large U1 symmetry at scry at futurnal infinity, and this is related to the soft photon theorem. So this is just to tell you that there is a very rich story going on here that I am not reviewing in detail, but that have paved the way to the thing that I will tell you in a moment. Is there maybe any question so far? If not, I hope that this story will become a little bit clearer in the following. So let me turn to the core of the talk, which is what I told in the beginning, namely to try to make sense of holography for flat spacetime. So one first thing to notice is a symmetry observation is that the four-dimensional Lorentz groups act on the celestial sphere as the global RSL2C group. In other words, the action of the Lorentz group on the coordinates of the sphere, Z and Z bar, is just the Möbius transformation or the SL2C action. So that means that almost by construction, scattering amplitudes, if one wants to rewrite them as some correlator on the sphere, because of the symmetry, they will share some properties of CFT2. And this has led Strominger and other people to come with a concise proposal for a flat space holography, which is called celestial holography and goes as follows. So I recall the celestial sphere, the 2D sphere at the boundary of futurnal infinity. So the celestial holography proposal aims at establishing the following correspondence between gravity and four dimension and the two-dimensional conformal field theory, which is called celestial conformal field theory that lives on the celestial sphere. So the idea is that if you have a scattering process happening in flat space with ingoing particles, so massless particle enter from scry minus, they interact and then exit at scry plus, they will enter scry minus and exit scry plus at a given point, they will pierce the sphere at this boundary at a given point, say z1 z bar 1. And the idea is that this scattering amplitude can be encoded into a correlators, 2D correlators of a celestial CFT. So each operator here mean that they create or annihilate an asymptotic particle that enters or exits the sphere at a given point z bar 1, and so on. So notice here that you might think there are kind of a 2 celestial sphere, one at scry plus and one at scry minus, but there is an identification which is made in such a way that a free massless particle would enter and exit the sphere at the same point. So there is really only one boundary sphere because of this identification. So that's the main picture of the celestial holography proposal. Of course, the whole idea is to try to understand what we can say about this celestial CFT. The word celestial is there just to mean that it might not be a usual kind of a CFT that we are used to deal with. But still, as you will see, they share some properties, but also differ from CFT in a precise sense. So, in order to go into this holographic picture, it turns out to be convenient to work with what is called a conformal basis. So we are used to work with energy momentum basis where we have plane waves that are labeled by a 4 momenta. And eventually, if they are spinning particle, 4-dimensional helicity. Instead, it turns out to be convenient to work with the new basis of plane waves, which is called a conformal basis and which is obtained by taking Mellin transforms of plane waves. So this integral here is a Mellin transform. So omega is the energy of the asymptotic particle, and the Mellin transform will basically trade the energy of the particle for this this delta here, which is actually a conformal dimension, because as we will see, this object now transforms manifestly as an SL2C primary of a certain conformal dimension delta. So the advantage of working with this basis is that now the conformal properties will become more manifest. But on the other hand, we lose the translation symmetry of the obvious, let's say, translation symmetry of the plane wave, where it was the opposite in the energy momentum basis. So now the plane wave will be labeled not anymore by a momentum p mu, but instead by a conformal dimension and a point on the celestial sphere. And their helicity, therefore the helicity will be identified with the 2D spin in the celestial CFT. So let me know if there is any question.
I had a quick question about this, something from the previous slide. Are you just saying that the ingoing particle could, in principle, that operator could just be rewritten in terms of an outgoing operators, or are they actually 2 different types of operators in this theory?
So yeah, and basically the map between this thing is implemented by this Mellin transform. So I will be indeed describing an asymptotic particle by this object that I will identify with an operator in the celestial CFT, and I will give some examples of this operator in the following. But yes, that's the idea here. And on the amplitude side, you can really rewrite these amplitudes into this Mellin space and you can check that it takes the form of a correlators, that it looks like a correlation function of a CFT because of the symmetry, because of the fact that the action of the Lorentz group is the SL2C on the celestial sphere. And actually, yeah, this was my next slide. So a number of people have computed explicitly this 2D correlator. So what they have done is that they have taken Mellin transform of scattering amplitudes. If you have n particles, you would take n Mellin transforms. And they have checked, well, they have computed this right-hand side in a number of examples, and I have been working on that. So basically, does it answer your question?
No, sorry. Well, the main question was, can I tell if the operator corresponds to an incoming or outgoing particle, or are those... is that distinction from the CFT perspective not really useful or something?
Yeah, you can tell if it's in, you mean versus an incoming versus outgoing. Yes, you can you can make a difference between
that. Okay.
Yes.
I could map the operator to either an incoming or outgoing.
Yes, exactly. I have been a little bit sketchy with my formulas, but yeah, there is a label that is encoding that, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Actually, if I can ask a question.
Yeah, just of course.
You wrote, if you go to the other slide again, you wrote
this
that
one?
People...
this one? Sorry, yeah.
People have calculated the one loop corrections. Is there like any sort of expansion in the celestial CFT I can understand these one loop corrections as? So like, can I treat this as some small perturbation to my, to some sort of like tree level correlator? And does it teach you anything about the structure?
Yeah. So what people have been doing, they start really from the amplitude they know with the one loop amplitude, and they have taken Mellin transform. And actually, maybe Anna knows better than me actually about that. What is the what you learn from the one loop computation? I mean, I don't have the form of the.
One basic thing is that for the 4-point scattering amplitudes, you see that there is higher poles. Logarithms, basically, which come from loop corrections in momentum space, translate into higher order poles in this beta variable, which is the sum of all the external dimensions for 4-point functions. But I think for higher point functions, it's still like open question. Mm-hmm. Not that many amplitudes have been computed, as far as I know.
I see.
Except for universal features like IR divergences and stuff like that.
Yep. So, okay. So one question we were asking ourselves is, I told it now we work with this Mellin transform of the plane waves, where the notion of energy is kind of lost, because we are integrating over the energy and trading that for a conformal dimension delta. So what is the analog of a soft particle which has omega going to zero in this holographic formulation? And we propose that it should be replaced with the new notion, which is a conformally soft particle, for which now the limit you would take would be on the conformal dimension. And essentially, delta going to one would be called a conformally soft particle. So let me be a little bit more concrete. So the object we are working with, this Mellin transform of the plane waves, are given by this expression. So there are a couple of indices here that I want to explain. So we are basically introducing a null vector that is that lives in the 4D but is pointing towards a point WW bound celestial sphere. And for spin one, so you have an ellipticity index here, which can be positive or negative, depending if this index here takes the value W or W bar. It can be outgoing or incoming. This is the plus and minuses. And the expression for this object is just, as I told you, like roughly speaking, this is this spin one are Mellin transform of the plane waves, time and ellipticity factor. This actually can be seen to be the ellipticity, up to a residual transformation, a residual gauge transformation parametrized by this alpha. So the important thing about these solutions is that, okay, of course, they are a solution to four-dimensional Maxwell's equation, and they are in a certain gauge. In this gauge, the Maxwell's equation just reduced to box equals zero. And the fundamental property of this object is that they now transform this wave function transform as SL2C primaries. So if you do SL2C transformation on the angles, that you see that the transformation of this object is one of SL2C with weights H and H bar given by the sum and the difference of the conformal dimension and the spin. So this is a very, why we're interested working with these guys is because they have a manifest SL2C transformation. And they're actually another kind of primary wave function, which were computed by Pasterski and Shao, which is the so-called shadow transform. So in CFT, a shadow transformation maps you, if you have a primary of dimension delta, a shadow transform, which is denoted by this tilde here, will give you another primary, but now with the new dimension delta tilde, which is equal to 2 minus delta. So the shadow transform of this object were computed by these people, and they found the following expression. So this, what I call A tilde, are a new primary wave function. So X squared is just the square of the Cartesian coordinates with the dimension delta tilde, which is related to delta by this equation. So this is for spin one. You have very analogous objects for spin two. Now these objects H are solution to linearize Einstein's equation in the Donder gauge. Again, you can see that this is roughly speaking the Mellin transform of the plane wave times the polarization tensor of the graviton up to diffeomorphism here. And what Pasterki have shown is that if you look at the inner product, so this is a Klein-Gordon inner product for the spin one primary, and there is a more complicated inner product of symplectic structure for spin two. But if you take the inner product of these objects, they will span a basis. So they will give you a complete delta function normalizable basis when the conformal dimension delta lies on what is called the principal continuous series. So when delta is 1 plus I times a real number. So in other words, you know that when you go from the plane wave basis to the Mellin basis, you basically do not lose any information because you know that these objects span a full basis of wave functions. So checking the time. So what we looked at, and this is the relation between asymptotic symmetry part, is that in this so-called conformally sublimit, so when you take this delta, this conformal dimension delta to one, you can see that this wave function, basically this piece goes to zero. So you find that this function becomes a pure gauge generated by this alpha now. And if you write this mode in the Bondi coordinate expanding, take a large R expansion near future null infinity, you found that this mode is basically what basically is the Goldstone mode of U1 symmetry at scry. So the parameter is given by this expression here. And because delta is 1 and j is 1, you can see that these objects will transform as a 1, 0. And actually, there is a way to associate an operator to this mode, which is called JZ. So it's a 1, 0. And it satisfies on the celestial sphere some precise OPE relationship with an operator of certain dimension delta, which is the OPE of a Kac-Moody current, as you expect from his weight. And in other words, this OPE relation can be understood as the celestial manifestation of the Sofoton theorem. Remember in the beginning, I told you that asymptic symmetry had to do with soft theorems. And for spin one, this conformal soft mode is associated to the soft photon theorem. Now, if you compute the inner product of this involving this conformally soft mode, you land on the soft photon charge, which is the charge at null infinity. Now for spin two, the story is similar in the sense that in the conformally soft limit delta goes to 1, you see that this primary becomes a pure diffeomorphism, which is now can be seen to be the Goldstone mode of super translation symmetry on the celestial sphere. So this is the expansion of the primary after a large R expansion. And if you recall, this is exactly what is the inner shift of a super translation symmetry, namely how a super translation acts on the gravitational data CZZ. You can see basically that this conformally soft mode is a pure shift symmetry. Again, you can compute the inner product of this mode and you find the super translation charge. Now, a very interesting feature of this guy is that it has really funny weights from a CFT perspective, because now delta is 1 and j is 2. So it transforms as a 3/2 minus a half primary. And as such, it has quite an unconventional action as an operator. Actually, there is an operator which is called a super translation current that you can associate it to this mode that satisfies the following OPE on the celestial sphere. And you can see that because of this funny weight here, this super translation current shifts the dimension of the operator by 1 unit. So this is a pretty funny OPE from the CFT's perspective. And I guess it really comes from the fact that super translation symmetry really has no analog in conventional CFT. So they have a pretty funny features that actually are very interesting. So is there a question at this stage?
Yeah, maybe you can say something about like holomorphicity and so on, in particular for the spin one, but maybe also spin two. So is there, if you just go back one slide, is there like a similar operator where I have h bar equal to 1 and h equal to 0?
Right. There's all these guys have an anti-holomorphic story that I'm not developing, but yeah, you have a anti-holomorphic J bar here that is
And what would that correspond to? Is this like a different helicity photon or like incoming or?
Right, so that would be the guy associated with negative helicity in this case. Yeah, exactly. And then you would find a Z bar, which is the Z bar of some, yeah, exactly. Okay. Something yep. like, yeah.
Okay, makes sense. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, so here I've been pretty quick on that. Just long story short, this is just to tell you that this conformally sublimit captured the asymptotic symmetry somehow. And on the celestial sphere, there is a way to associate an operator and its OPE is actually secretly the Sofoton theorem. So now for spin two, there was a kind of a puzzle in the literature. So I see there is some orange thing happening in the chat. I don't know if there are questions or if Dominic, there are questions, let me know. You're muted. Yeah.
We can maybe, if that question, I mean, there's been another question, which I wanted to read after, but we can maybe take this question. No, yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, so Jihoon was asking if on the previous slide, yeah, you can understand this O of delta plus one as the descendant of O delta in some sense.
Oh, right. Actually, this PZ is the descendant of the operator associated to this guy here. So yeah, so this PZ actually transform as a 3/2 plus 1/2 because this PZ is a DZ of these modes. So yeah, that's actually, yeah.
Okay,
I can take question at the end or so.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, so now there was a puzzle in the literature which basically goes as follow. So I told you that there is a correspondence between wired identity associative symmetries and soft theorems. Now there were two proposals in the literature for what are these superrotations. The thing was that it was shown that the subleading subgraviton theorem implied the Virasoro wired identity. So when by Virasoro, I mean just the superrotation are taken to be holomorphic functions, but it was not bijective. In other words, there was no proof that this wired identity implied the subleading subgraviton theorem. And then Campilli and Lada came and proposed that we should enlarge the asymptotic symmetries to allow for a full diffeomorphism on the two sphere. In that case, the vector field YZ and YZ bar would be allowed to be any function of Z and Z bar. And in that case, they showed that there was a one-to-one correspondence between the soft graviton theorem and the wired identity associated to superrotation. Now superrotation understood at any diff S2. So this was a bit puzzling story. And what we try to understand is to resolve this kind of tension in the celestial holography picture. And basically the resolution goes as follow. So I'm working now with the spin two primaries, and the two important cases will be when delta equals zero, or when the shadow transform, which is labeled by delta tilde, is equal to two. So now what happens for these two modes is that they both reduce to pure diffeomorphisms, as you can see here. And when expanding near square, you can see that there are actually the Goldstone mode of superrotations. And this shadow primary here with delta tilde equal two corresponds to the Barney Troussard or Vera Zorro kind of super rotations. Indeed, they are meromorphic functions, and they violate the conformal killing vector condition at isolated points. In other words, they are not globally well defined, and because of that, they introduce some singularity into the celestial sphere, which goes as delta functions. Now, the other primary delta equals zero is given by this expression here. And this guy really drastically changed the celestial sphere metric. Now, not only at singular points, but will basically not satisfy the Bondi fall off and will not preserve the celestial sphere metric. So these two vector fields are related by a shadow transform. And you can compute the charge associated to this vector field. So I'm skipping you some extra detail. It's basically saying that the symplectic structure requires to undergo a renormalization procedure. After you do this renormalization procedure, you find an expression for the soft charge. And the soft charge evaluated for this shadow transform delta tilde equal two mode will give you a charge that is that was previously found by Anna here and collaborators at Harvard, what they have called the two-distress tensor for four-dimensional gravity, given by this expression here. Indeed, these objects transform nicely as a 2,0. And it was called, it's actually a stress tensor because it was shown that this insertion into S matrix satisfied the wired identity of a stress tensor. Now the other mode, the delta equals zero non-shadow mode, you can compute this charge. And what you find is now the shadow transform of this stress tensor, which has now weight -1,1, and that we call the shadow stress tensor. So the shadow transform flipped the helicity, that what it goes from W to W bar, and the tilde denotes the fact that it's the shadow of this mode. So this charge story were actually very tricky because you really need to renormalize the symplectic structure properly and keep all the contact terms that appear in these computations. And you recover previous expressions that were found in a Bondi gauge or different gauge and different works by these people. So in other words, from the point of view of the celestial CFT, the connection is as follows. So you have these two modes that are pure gauge, the gravity mode with delta tilde equal two, which is the shadow of the delta equal zero guy. They both lead to an object. One transforms the 2,0 is the 2D stress tensor, and one transforms the -1,1. And these guys are naturally related with the shadow transform. In other words, from the celestial perspective, there is a way to go from the wired identity associated to super rotations if you allow for a shadow transform. Yes, Laurent Freidel, you have a question.
Yeah. Hello, Laurent. Yeah, I have a question about the shadow transform. Do you have an understanding of what it is from the space-time point of view, or let's say in your momentum basis, so I can get a better feel of what is this transformation?
That's a good question. So from the if you want to find this mode, you would have really to relax the boundary condition, the BMS boundary condition, and allow violation of the of the.
That I understand. I'm asking more about the transformation itself. Like, can you translate what this shadow transformation is in the momentum basis, and then extend what kind of transformation it is in terms of in terms of the space-time fields.
Right. So from the space-time perspective, the shadow operation is basically, so imagine you can have a spin two guy here, H. So the shadow transform is multiplying by this X square. So in Bondi coordinates will be U to R minus U. That's what it would do to your wave function, basically.
And in the momentum space basis? Is it a
So
go back to the plane wave basis.
If you go back to the plane wave, I know what it does on this.
Is it something non-local? Is it like a local field transformation? Is it?
I would expect it's something non-local, but it's true that I haven't worked out what would be the That should be doable, like in inverse Melendez relationship, and see what it gives. Yeah, that's a good thing to look at. Yeah. Good. Yeah, because it would give more insight onto the asymptotic symmetry business. So yeah, basically, if you allow for shadow transform, then these two proposal are, let's say, on equal footing. So one mild statement is that the asymptotic symmetry for the flat space should be closed under shadow transform. So I think I'm running out of time. So let me go to a conclusion. So I think now we have understood that physics in the deep infrared is much richer and more subtle than we thought. We have this infinite amount of symmetry, BMS super translation and super rotations. And now we have came with a unified treatment of this conformally soft Goldstone mold, which are associated to the spontaneous breaking of the symmetries on the celestial holography perspective. And in general, the properties of celestial, what is a celestial CFT? I think we are just starting to understand what they are and what constraint they should satisfy. They share some property with the CFT we know, but they also differ in ways that are actually not very understood so far. And they must be subject. They have suggested to a multiple a great amount of symmetry constraint. Actually, a couple of infinity of asymptotic symmetry constraint, which have no analog of in conventional CFT. One example of that is the super translation symmetry. And we hope that by further exploring this object, we will pave the way towards a holographic formulation of flat space by constraining constraining more and more what the OPEs have to be and what the celestial CFT have to satisfy. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Laura. I think questions would be good. Now. So if anyone has questions, just unmute yourself maybe and start asking.
I have a question to continue on this. So if I understand properly, you have these two generator, the charges. I'm looking at the charges in the algebra. So you have the Virasoro charges, which are the generator, and then you have the dual charges or the shadow transform charges. So the Virasoro charges form a subalgebra of the symmetry algebra. The question is about does the shadow transform also form a subalgebra?
That's a very good point. Something that I need to understand, and I think the answer is no. But
And then I guess the claim that you want to make, which is maybe not yet proven, is that if you take together the Virasoro charge and their shadow, together they form an algebra that is DFS2. That's
right. Yeah. 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 Which. Yeah.
And this would mean that if Virasoro has a central charge, so now there is some kind of central extension of this. I mean,
yes.
We know that there's no central extension of DFS2, so there's kind of maybe a tension between the two.
That's true. And I would say that even if you just stick to the Virasoro perspective, the central extension story is not, I mean, from the asymptic symmetry business, it's very weird, right? There's this work by Glenn Barnish that they found a central term between the super translation and super rotation, which was a field dependent central extension and so on and so forth. So indeed the central extension is something that is definitely worth looking at. And indeed, whether it's zero, it might be just be, yeah. It's not fully understood so far, but it's very interesting to look at. And indeed, put this in parallel with the DFS too, yeah.
Okay, any other question?
Can I ask also a clarification on the, I think I just wasn't following the details of the shadow transformation.
Right, yeah, I've been a little bit fast on that.
Well, yeah, I was just wondering, so it's just like this question of like, which one is, well, yeah, it seems like the DFS2 charges are the ones that are clearly generating a local symmetry on the space-time. Is that correct? And then the shadow transform, it's not clear the transformation, like the geometric action on the space-time, or did I miss something there?
So the guys that, so the symmetries that, let me see if I understood your question well. So the charge associated to this Virasoro delta equal two mode, they really produce a shift. So yeah, they generate this kind of action. So if you take, say, the bracket of the charge associated to this mode, basically they would generate this kind of thing, which is in the usual, well, which is asymptically flat in the sense of Bondi-Mesner-Zaks if you just care about local properties. On the other hand, the non-shadow guy, so the primary which has delta equals zero, will just totally mess with your boundary metric. So we'll produce this kind of action.
Yeah, so let me see. But these are both charges, like from the gravity perspective, they're just both charges I would get from the symplectic form.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh. Yeah, exactly. If you want, they're reduced to these charges where for different values of this y here. So y for this mode is just 1 over z minus w. That's why when you take three derivative, you get this. And for this mode, this quantity, dz cube yz, is just a delta function, actually. And this can be seen to be related by a shadow transform. But yes, they both modulo a normalization procedure that was also actually studied by Compare and other people. They can be understood as charge, really. I mean, of an enlarged phase space, if you allow for the full DFS tool. But yeah.
So let me maybe read a question which we got earlier. That goes back to the question about loop corrections. So if how you translate loop corrections into the celestial CFT. The question is, do the loop terms on the left-hand side, so that was the metal transform of the amplitude, become, say, anomalous dimensions of CFT operators on the right-hand side? So yeah, I guess the question is if you calculate higher loop corrections, do you see some sort of anomalous dimensions?
On the celestial amplitude story, I have to say I'm not an expert on that, so I will refer to Anna for these details of the story. Yeah,
I'm not sure. I think that's an interesting question, but one thing that is known is that I think exponentiation of IR divergences does lead to some kind of renormalization of the weights on the celestial sphere, but yeah, there are some sort of shifts, but I'm not sure in what sense that would be like an anomalous.
Okay. And then I actually might have a question which might be a very stupid one, but if you go to one of your last slides where you explained how the shadow transform relates.
Right.
This one. How do I understand? So if the top two are related by the shadow transform, how do I understand that sort of like the Virasoro ward entity and the subleading soft graviton theorem is not bijective, whereas on the right hand side? Right, it seems like I could just go the detour.
Yeah, exactly. You can go the detour, but right, it's that's the whole point that we didn't understand, right? And this way actually why somehow you really need to use somehow if you start with the wired identity, you need to plug there a vector field which is not a Virasoro. You need to plug something actually that is such that its third derivative is a delta function to land on the subleading subgraviton theorem. And if you say from the beginning that the game is that you would only allow for local CKV, then you will not have this vector field at hand from the beginning. But if now you go from the shadow transform and you make all this detour, I think that's what we were happy with, is that you can recover the theorem. But yeah, basically it's from the choices that you make here. But if you shadow this, then you're into business, because you can take a normal 1 over z minus w vector field, shadow it, and then you can make this story. But you have to be aware of this possibility somehow.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Are there any more questions? Laurent looks like he wants to say something.
Yeah. I mean, one natural conclusion, maybe it's more a point of conclusion. In some sense, what Dominique is pointing out and what you're saying is that, okay, the Virasoro symmetry is a subalgebra of the boundary symmetry group. The symmetry group is much bigger. DFS2 is way bigger than Virasoro. So it means that ultimately, we should think beyond CFTs. That is the thing which is organizing the expression at infinity. It's not a boundary CFT. It's something bigger than that, in the sense that it has this DFS2 symmetry. And so I think, and which is, what I'm saying is that it's very clear from the finite, if you look at the finite group symmetry, it's clear that everything organized in terms of representation of DFS2 on the sphere and the way they evolve. So maybe there's, what you're pointing out is that there's a shift of change, that the boundary symmetry group of gravitational theories is not simply CFTs. It's,
right, exactly. Yeah.
More, and CFTs are just a subgroup.
Exactly. And it's funny because the original motivation, I think, for celestial holography was what people were excited is to find a Virasoro symmetry. Originally, that was motivated all the story. And then by looking deeper, now we start to tend to think that it's actually, much bigger.
This is maybe what's interesting, is that people expected CFT because they know we're finding there's a deeper symmetry principle behind gravity. And in small space, but by extension, even in asymptotic ADS, you're going to find similar stories. But that's in some sense, there's something, you're revealing something deeper about this integral operator. It's not just about CFT.
And can I have a question? Where do you see that the representation organized so clearly in DFS2? What do you have in mind? I'm just wondering if you have a different. How do you? Yeah.
Well, one way to see it, and it's maybe a longer conversation, is to view infinity simply, as you're saying, everything takes place on one sphere. So now imagine you can do infinity as a very large sphere, and everything you say about asymptotic symmetry, boundary symmetry, algebra, all of that survives, in fact, that sphere having a finite area. And then you see that at finite area, it's very easy to establish, and that's something we did with William Donnelly a few years ago, that the core of the symmetry algebra contains a DFS2, and that, you know, what's less obvious is that that DFS2 has some kind of, is conformally invariant. So in some sense, when you push it to infinity, it survives. Mm-hmm. That is maybe way, as you're saying, it involves renormalization of the symplectic potential and the proper boundary Lagrangian and all of that. So that part is harder to see, but at some very elementary level, it's, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks. Because I wanted to have your personal take on this. Yeah.
Could I ask another question about the DFS2 appearing here? Is there any sense in which you're considering, I don't know if this is just like a minor detail, but like, is this diff S2, are you thinking of it as the regular diffs, or are you also thinking of singular diffs? Because there's some sense in which Virasoro is not a subalgebra of diff S2, in the sense of, if I think of diff S2 as regular diffs.
I'm taking them as any diff, so in particular, including the Virasoro, when I talk about DFS2, that's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So it's, in principle, bigger than just the regular diffs of the sphere. But like, could I get this subleading soft theorem only using regular diffs, or does it come about from singular diffs somewhere?
No, you can get them from the regular ones, I would say. Yeah. Yeah, to me, the diff S2, they include the Virasoro.
What's singular is not the diff. What's singular is the Bondi boundary condition. It's very clear in the compare paper that, or in other papers, that what's singular is the restriction that you want the sphere to be just, you know, the regular spherical sphere. And that's in conflict with, you know, emission of gravitational radiation or certain physical process. So the Bondi boundary condition is simply too restrictive. It restricts the sets of bulk solutions. So once you relax that boundary conditions, then you're fine.
Right. Except that the symplectic structure is divergent and you need to, exactly.
Well, it's not that you need to add the proper boundary. Yeah, you need to do something. You can't just take what's, but if you think about ADS-CFT, in fact, the first step of ADS-CFT is first a renormalization of the Lagrangian before you even talk about ADS-CFT, right?
So true.
That's the first step. You first renormalize the boundary symplectic structure before you can talk about the source and you know, identify properly.
The story is that the moral of every story is that we always impose too strong boundary condition.
That's why I was talking about the finite, because at the finite case, you have the softer, and you don't have to do anything in terms of boundary condition. And then if you're convinced that every single symmetry that exists in the finite case survives infinity, then you just have to prove it. You just have to see how to subtract the divergent term and show that the divergent terms are essentially boundary terms, which is not easy to prove, and not fully yet proven.
Yes, there is always this ambiguity in the renormalization procedure that I think is not totally resolved, in the sense that, to my understanding, one needs still need to require consistency with the subtheorem to completely fix the renormalization. There is no, well, at least I don't know a generic print, even in the compare paper, they have to resort to subtheorems to really come with their bounded, their counter term somehow to add.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yet, I think it's possible, but it's not yet done, a purely space-time derivation of the renormalization at right. the same level that it exists for ADS-CFT.
But yes.
I do believe it's the next natural step.
Yeah, that would be nice to have a guiding principle that is telling you what is the renormalization from the beginning without having to resort to this subtheorem. Well, at least I would like to understand that.
Yeah, I'm just going to stop the recording. So in case there are any more secretive questions.
Yeah, you are recording. That's true.